Previously on Beta.
The basement door closes and out come the lighters and the drugs, and I am sure Donna's down there bouncing around without a bra.
Sweetheart, I know everything about you. You're 28 to 34. Your online interests include music, movies, and laser hair removal. You have a modest but dependable disposable income. Am I the only one not getting the problem here?
The Voyne shower handle. University of Southern Mississippi. Hingle McCringleberry, Penn State University.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, the renowned sportscaster Jim Gray reflects on what it's like to cover the greatest athletes and most transcendent moments in TV sports history.
I've always admired and respected Mike because, unlike so many people who do things wrong, and this was a despicable, heinous act, okay? It was awful. He had the wherewithal, and he came out and he answered the questions.
And later, Eels frontman Mark Oliver Everett talks about his band's album, Earth to Dora.
I wanted it to hopefully have like kind of a timeless quality to where if you heard it in 5 or 10 years, you wouldn't go, oh, that sounds like 2020.
But first, we'll put on our bell bottoms and crank up our 8-tracks, and we may even light up a, well, maybe not, but we'd be a lot cooler if we did. That's right, it's time to talk about filmmaker Richard Linklater's 1993 cult movie, Dazed and Confused. Originally pitched as an updated American Graffiti, Linklater's movie about the last day of school in 1976 ended up resonating with fans from all generations. Led by an ensemble cast of up-and-coming actors, including future Oscar winners Matthew McConaughey and Ben Affleck, Dazed may well be the definitive movie about the high school experience. A lot of the people who have seen it think it's about them. Writer Melissa Mertz is one of those people. She's one of the founders of Vulture and the author of All Right, All Right, All Right, the oral history of Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused. The title, of course, riffing off McConaughey's famous catchphrase from the movie. Melissa interviewed nearly 150 people involved with the film, including Linklater himself, and she says there were as many good stories behind the camera as there were on screen.
Yeah, so I love the movie, obviously, but I knew that it'd be good stories behind it because it was such a hinge point in so many people's lives. You know, it was the first studio movie for Richard Linklater. It was the first movie, period, for a lot of the cast, including Matthew McConaughey.
All right, all right, all right.
And I'd also heard that there were some really good partying behind the scenes stories, so I just thought that there'd be a lot of good stories to tell.
Mm-hmm. You argue that the fact that Dazed and Confused doesn't really have a plot means it holds up better with repeat viewings. How so?
Yeah, because I think what happens is so many people have told me, like, oh, I played that movie a million times over one summer and just kind of had it on in the background. And I think it really is a hangout movie.
So, guys, are we going to play poker tonight?
Count me out. I'll probably be going to Pickford's party later, okay?
We should do something like that, you know? Yeah. Good one's off on a senior trip. We can play poker anytime.
Go to a party?
Okay. Go to a party?
Come on.
Mike.
Come on. Don't worry about it. It's under control.
I don't generally feel comfortable with those kinds of things.
Pick us up at 8.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
It's going to be all right.
Okay, I guess we're going to the party then. Okay.
All right. So you're not really watching for the story. You're watching to hang out with these people. And I think a lot of people know a Wooderson. A lot of people know a Slater. I mean, these characters feel familiar to people. So I think that contributes to some of the longevity that the movie has.
Mm. And if it had more plot than it does, then we'd get bored of it because, oh, this twist, we've already seen it kind of thing, right?
Yeah, if you're just watching for the story, you're not as much, you know, lingering in the vibe of the movie, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. You say that Linklater was smart enough to realize the mythologizing of the 60s was a lie perpetrated by boomers, and he didn't want to glorify the 70s either. Do you think that he stayed true to his intention to not glorify the 70s?
Well, this is the thing I talked to him about all the time. I think he would say that he discovered in the process of making this movie that it's impossible not to glorify the era that you're putting on screen. I mean, he even has a character in Dazed and Confused say outright that the 70s obviously suck.
The 50s were boring. The 60s rocked. The 70s, oh my God, they obviously suck. Right? Come on. Maybe the 80s will be radical. You know, I figure we'll be in our 20s and, hey, it can't get any worse.
And people still see that movie as glorifying the 70s. And I think that's just the process of cinema. You put something on screen and it automatically becomes kind of glorified, like a war movie. You know, you can make an anti-war movie like Saving Private Ryan and put it on screen and people still see it as a very glorified representation of war. So I think it's very hard to make an anti-nostalgia movie about the 70s and not have it be something that makes people nostalgic.
Yeah. The actor Sasha Jensen told you that it just felt like the cast members were all playing together and there just happened to be cameras there. What was it about the way Linklater worked with these young actors that made them feel like that?
Well, he was so smart. He sent out a letter before they even got to Austin to start shooting that basically said, if you don't like your character, change it. You know, bring in something that's real from your life. And I think a lot of them got really into bringing their own experience to these characters. And there was a blurring of the lines between who they were behind the scenes, you know, creating chemistry together, partying together, having this great time in Austin, and what was happening on the screen. And you look at the movie, it's really clear that that chemistry is real. It almost has kind of a documentary type vibe to it. It feels very natural.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, Linklater was serving more as a, although he was in fact a director and made the final decisions, but in a way he was kind of a collaborator too, which is kind of unusual among directors, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he definitely had a vision for this movie that stayed through the whole time. But I think he's very honest about the fact that he encouraged everybody to contribute, to, you know, improvise. In some cases, they wrote their own scenes. You know, it's interesting. He was a high school athlete. He was in both baseball and football. And I think I kind of see him as a coach, that that's the way he approaches directing, is by being the guy who gets the best performance out of everybody, by kind of finding the one thing inside them that inspires them to give that performance.
Yeah. You say that Matthew McConaughey's approach to his role as the character of Wooderson helped transform the character from a tiny role into the movie's most memorable personality. What did he do to accomplish that?
Yeah. So if you look at the original screenplay just on the page, his character is not only a very small character, but also just kind of a much darker, sadder character. Just kind of seems like a pure predator, somebody who you want to stay away from. And I think that he also brought some charm to that role, which makes it so much more complicated. Like, he's still a really creepy guy, but you can see how people are, you know, attracted to being around him.
You know Wooderson?
Oh. How's it going, man?
Hey. Pretty good. How's it going with you?
Say, man, you got a joint?
No, not on me, man.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did.
So I think he really towed that line between, you know, is this guy a predator or is he somebody who's mostly harmless and mostly all talk? He really kind of transformed that character.
Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, that famous line, very predatory line, which, what is it, something like?
That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Parker Posey and Joey Lauren Adams improvised some of the film's best lines. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite lines in the movie is,
"Wipe that face off your head, bitch."
Which is Parker Posey says it when she's hazing the freshman. And, you know, that came from, this is so strange, but it came from a mistranslation from German into English of a Brecht play that she had performed. And she just ended up using it in the movie. And it's so great. It feels so high school. It does not feel like Brecht at all. Wipe that face off your head. But also, I think one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the scene where Parker Posey and Joey Lauren Adams and Dina Martin are in the car and they're talking about, what did she say about me? You know, some unseen girl talking about the gossip that she'd spread about them behind the scenes. And they wrote that scene themselves. And it's, I think, a very relatable scene for anyone who's been a high school girl.
Wow, yeah. So their improvising really did help flesh out their characters, didn't it?
Definitely.
Let's talk a little bit about the movie soundtrack. Linklater put a lot of time and effort into choosing the songs that are on the film soundtrack. What is the legacy of the Dazed and Confused soundtrack?
Yeah, well, we forget that this was an era when soundtracks really made bands, right? I mean, it was a time when MTV would show a video for Bohemian Rhapsody and show footage from Wayne's World in it, and it would, you know, help bring a comeback for Queen. So, you know, soundtracks were already really important, but I think Linklater's genius in this movie was that he knew that classic rock and 70s rock was going to be popular slightly before it became a really mainstream, widespread thing. thing. Like, it was really in the later 90s when classic rock radio became a widespread thing. So before the cast came to Austin, he sent them letters that said, you know, here's the soundtrack I'm imagining for this movie. Some of these songs are a little intentionally cheesy. Some of them are going to be played for ironic usage, but I thought you should get into them beforehand. And I think what happened was, it's hard to tell what songs are supposed to be cheesy and what songs are just legitimately great. And I think the cast listened to them and thought they were all kind of legitimately great.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite song that the way it was used in Dazed and Confused?
I mean, everybody loves Slow Ride in the beginning with that car coming around the bend. But I have to say, I think Tuesday Is Gone is one of my favorite songs in the movie because it is so filled with nostalgia. Like, you see these kids in this party already nostalgic about this night that's not even over yet. And you hear that song playing like, oh, Tuesday is gone with the wind. It really feels accurate for that scene.
Do you have one favorite scene in Dazed and Confused? I know you've mentioned a couple, but is there one standout scene that is your favorite?
I love the scene on the football field after the party when Jason London gets up and the camera kind of pans around him while his friends are behind him. And you get the sense that this is the one time in the movie, he has that famous line in that scene that's,
all I'm saying is that if I ever start referring to these as the best years of my life, remind me to kill myself.
And this whole movie, these kids have not been thinking about anything beyond what's going to happen that night, how they're going to get beer, how they're going to get to the party. And this is the one moment when he's really taking a step outside of himself and thinking about the future, how he's going to look back on this night when he's an adult. And I think it's a really powerful scene, especially since that character is based on Richard Linklater. And Richard Linklater is the one filming this scene as an adult looking back on his teenage years. It's just a really layered scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great scene. I was surprised to learn that three people who grew up with Linklater sued him for defamation and negligent infliction of emotional distress. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the real-life Wooderson, the real-life Slater, and the real-life Pink Floyd were the ones who brought the lawsuit. And I think it was really Andy Slater, who has the same name, obviously, as Slater in the movie, although Richard Linklater says he's not a one-on-one, you know, comparison. But I think he felt like people saw that movie, and they really started to see him as just kind of a dumb stoner, and he was upset. He felt hurt by it, so they brought this lawsuit against Linklater. But I think it also shows you how personal this movie is for so many people. You know, I talked to a lot of people who went to high school with Linklater in Huntsville, Texas, and everybody thinks there's a character based on them. And not even in Huntsville. Like, you know, people in the world at large, I think, really believe that there are characters who are exactly like them in high school. And I think that shows you why this movie is so personal for so many people.
Mm-hmm. You say that Linklater believed that Dazed and Confused contradicted the notion of nostalgia. How so?
I think he just wanted to show that the 70s were kind of boring, that, you know, when he was growing up, everybody thought we missed it. We missed the 60s. We missed all the great rock and roll and all the great drugs and the revolution. And now we're just stuck in the 70s. So I think he really wanted to show that that was the case. But I think what happened was, you know, even the cast was, you know, being dressed in these costumes and listening to this music that they'd never listened to before, and just really started to think, this seems like fun. This seemed like the last time that kids were kind of unsupervised by their parents, that they could just kind of run free. You know, Affleck talks about how you could drink and drive in that time and no one would say anything. Obviously, that's not a great thing. But I think they just saw it as a time that was unleashed for kids.
And it just seems that, like you were talking about earlier, it always seems that whatever era we're in, it's human nature to sort of say, oh, things would have been better for me 10 years ago or a couple of decades ago, like here we are in 2020, and this is not turning out to be a great year. So, you know, a lot of us maybe have fantasies about, oh, I wish I could go back, travel back to 2000 or something, or the 2010s even.
Always. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, there were always the kids who were even 2 years older than you. And you'd be like, oh, you know, things are never as good for us. We never had as good of parties as they did. You know, I wish that I had graduated when they graduated. And I think it's like that with decades, too, that a lot of people think whenever they graduated that, you know, one decade or two decades previous, that's when the real cool time was.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Very well said. Can you point to one person besides Richard Linklater who was the most helpful in helping you learn about Dazed and Confused, what went on behind the scenes?
Yeah, I mean, Sandra Adair, who is the longtime editor who's worked with Richard Linklater, I interviewed her and she was like, you know, I think I still have some boxes of just a bunch of stuff from Dazed and Confused if you want to come to Austin and check them out. So I dug through these boxes and there was just gold in these boxes. I mean, there are memos, there are angry memos that Richard Linklater sent to the executives at Universal, fighting over the music, fighting over the schedule, fighting over Jim Jacks, you know, threatening to leave if Jim Jacks, the producer, wasn't, you know, taken away from the set. And I really felt like those captured his voice at the time. So I kept them in the book. You know, it might be a controversial decision to put that in an oral history, but I really felt like I needed it to show you the difference between how he felt then and how he feels now, looking back.
When you approached him, was it difficult to get Richard Linklater's permission to convince him that this was a good thing to do?
Yes, he did not want to do it at first. You know, I sent him an email and asked him about it, and he took a little while to get back to me. And then he was like, I'm kind of sick of talking about Dazed and Confused. I don't think it's my best movie. I think it's middling at best. But then by the end of this email, he was like, you know, but have you read this thing about it? And have you seen this thing about it? He was kind of pointing me towards sources. So I think the more he talked to me, the more open he was to talking to me. And I think he's also the kind of guy who is just very supportive of creative people and their projects, especially if they take place, you know, outside of the normal trajectory toward, you know, bestseller success.
Yeah. What is the legacy of Dazed and Confused?
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, it was so radical at the time because we were coming out of the John Hughes era, which was so plot driven. It was so about like the kids had to lose their virginity or have a massive party at some rich kid's house, or everything was just very dramatic. And I think Dazed showed that most of the time being a teenager is not dramatic. Most of the time it's kind of boring and you're kind of waiting around for something to happen.
I'm just saying, if we're going to go out, we're going to drive around, we should just do something. Oh.
Yeah, you know, you're right, man. I'm just going to, you know, get drunk, maybe get laid, or get in a fight.
No, I'm serious, man. We should be up for anything.
I know, we are. But what? I mean, God, don't you ever feel like everything we do and everything we've been taught is just to service the future?
Yeah, I know. It's like it's all preparation.
Right, but what are we preparing ourselves for?
Death.
Life of the party.
It's true.
You know, but that's valid. Because if we're all gonna die anyway, shouldn't we be enjoying ourselves now? You know, I'd like to quit thinking of the present, like right now, as some minor, insignificant preamble to something else.
Exactly, man. That's what everybody in this car needs. It's some good old, worthwhile, visceral experience.
And I think you see the influence of that in a bunch of movies now. You see it in the movie Mid-90s. You see it in Booksmart. You know, both those filmmakers said that they were directly inspired by Dazed and Confused. So I think it definitely had an influence on this new wave of directors.
Melissa Mertz, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be on.
Melissa Mertz is the author of All Right, All Right, All Right, the oral history of Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused. Find out more about Melissa and Dazed and Confused at wpr.org/beta.
But then I sequenced it in a way so if some listeners want to, they can listen to it as if it is all about one relationship. There is a certain arc to the sequence where you could sort of follow a storyline.
Eels frontman Mark Oliver Everett on the band's album Earth to Dora. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Mark Oliver Everett, also known as E, is the founder and frontman of the indie band Eels. He is the core of a rotating group of musicians that creates a unique spin on pop music in the vein of John Lennon. His songs are often personal and explore the dark side of the human condition. Eels have just released their 13th album, Earth to Dora. Dora is the band's former lighting director. She was feeling down, so Mark tried to cheer her up with some optimistic texts. He realized that their texts back and forth would work well as song lyrics and might cheer up listeners. Beta's Steve Gotcher sat down with Mark to find out more about the album.
On the surface, when I think about my life in the last couple of years, there hasn't been that many overtly hopeful things going on personally, and of course we're all going through a tough time as well. But I think, you know, the songs are usually start as like a message to myself, and I think it's first me trying to cheer myself up, and then hopefully once they become songs and they're on a record, they can also serve to cheer some other people up too.
It just seems like the very first song, Anything for Boo, it surprised me. It was so hopeful sounding.
Yeah, well, that was inspired by a real romantic situation I was involved in that didn't turn out the way I'd hoped it was going to turn out. So it was kind of a fantasy about that situation turning out the way I hoped it would, but unfortunately it remains a fantasy. But it's still probably my favorite song on the record for some reason. I like the hopefulness in it.
I think that good songwriting is probably one of the hardest things to do. To do it well, do you have to be willing to be open and honest in what you're writing about?
I suppose that's a case-by-case basis, you know, based on who the writer is and what they're writing about. And, you know, because probably only about half of my songs are really based on autobiographical situations, and the other half might be inspired by a story that happened to a friend of mine or someone I know, and then the rest are just fiction that I make up. But I think even when it's fiction, and you know, if I'm playing a character in a song in my mind, you still have to be able to relate to it. And then the thing that I like to do is just try to take all my filters off and be as real as possible and get to the heart of the matter as quickly as possible. And you just like peel away all the layers of the onion.
Yeah, that seems like kind of a very dangerous thing to do in that you expose yourself to everyone out there. Have you ever looked at what you've written and wondered if you have gone too far?
A lot. It's funny because it really comes natural to me at this point to write that way. And it's not a hardship for me to write like that. The hard part, and when I realize like that aspect is there, is the first time I have to sing it in front of the guys in the band when we're recording it. That then I suddenly feel incredibly vulnerable. You know, I'm usually in the vocal booth and they'll be up in the control room. Suddenly I'm sitting there and I realize, oh man, I'm about to like pour my heart out to the dudes in the band. And who, you know, I can't see them. They're probably up there rolling their eyes and laughing, I'm imagining, you know. It's an incredibly vulnerable experience.
And yet you continue to do it, and you seem to feel comfortable with that.
Well, I think the uncomfortableness that I feel at that point is probably a good sign. I hope that it means that I'm onto something in what I'm singing, that it's meaningful if it's making me so embarrassed and uncomfortable.
One of the songs that I think is kind of illustrative of this is I Got Hurt, which seems to be kind of a difficult song to write if it's from your perspective, although I read that it really isn't. Can you tell me a little bit about this song?
Well, that one, I try not to get specific about what the experience of me being hurt might have been that it inspired that particular song. I wanted it to be something that the listener could apply their own hurt, whatever it is, easily enough to it. It's so subjective. I'd rather not address. How did I get here into such an ugly mess?
Earth to Dora is your 13th record. What were you trying to do differently with this record from the other ones?
Well, the thing about, you know, I wanted to just make it flow like a nice playlist of old school singer-songwriter songs with kind of traditional instrumentation. I wanted it to hopefully have like kind of a timeless quality to where if you heard it in 5 or 10 years, you wouldn't go, oh, that sounds like 2020.
What do you think 2020 sounds like?
A lot of crying and agony.
It seems kind of like a concept record in a way about a relationship development and growth and then problems. Did you write it that way and sequence it that way? Is that what you wanted?
I didn't write it that way, but I did sequence it that way. The songs are really, were all written at different times, and they're not all about the same relationship, and some of them aren't even about a relationship I was in. But some of them are, and some of them are about the same relationship. But then I sequenced it in a way so if some listeners want to, they can listen to it as if it is all about one relationship. There is a certain arc to the sequence where you could sort of follow a storyline.
So in the process of putting this record together, did you learn anything about relationships that surprised you?
Well, you know, some of the songs are specifically about me trying to learn lessons, like the one called Who You Say You Are, which is kind of a song about songwriting and saying, hey, man, maybe you should be a little more cautious about who you write songs about and make sure they really, you know, are someone that's deserved of it. And then there's the one called Dark and Dramatic, which is a memo to myself saying, hey, man, don't you think at this point in your life you should have learned to pay more attention to some of the red flags that pop up early in a relationship and pay heed to the ones that are probably red enough flags that maybe you should get out of it while you can before it goes on too long?
Most of the songs were written before the COVID pandemic. Do you still think these songs are relevant and meaningful to people now, even though we're in a serious pandemic situation?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the one song on this album that was written after the pandemic started, and it was written in the early days when the pandemic first got really bad, it was me just having a daydream about what it might be like when it's all over and thinking about how nice that would be. And I was kind of secretly hoping, well, by the time the album comes out, maybe it'll be more of a reality and not a daydream. But of course, that didn't turn out, and it's every bit the daydream and fantasy it was the day I wrote it still. But I do think that, you know, there will eventually be a day when that song can be listened to and be thought of as more of a reflection of what things are like. And the other songs that were not written having any idea there was a pandemic about to start and all the other upheaval that's happened this year, I was a little bit worried, like, oh, are these songs just going to seem like completely ridiculous now because they don't have anything to do with what's going on in the world? But I've seen now that the album's been out for a little bit that people have really been embracing it. It's, you know, making some people feel good to think about something else.
Right, a diversion from what's going on all around them all the time.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's not necessarily these are the subject matters in these songs are things we used to, you know, worry about and deal with. You know, we'll get back to them. And also, some people are probably dealing with some of the subjects in the songs during this year as well. You know, we're not all alone in our bunker like me.
Are We All Right Again, you say, is a daydream. Has your daydream changed since the pandemic has gone on and on?
I mean, my daydream in that song is a little crazy. I just figured, well, if I'm going to have a daydream, I might as well go for it. And, you know, I'm like getting high with birds and marching with a marching band through the streets. And no, that still sounds pretty good to me right now.
You're quoted as saying, often we get saddled with, oh, this is the sad band and all that. But it's really missing the point, because if you look at pretty much all of the albums, the point is always an optimistic point. It's always saying, this is part of life. If I can say, you can go through these kinds of experiences like I've been through and still find the beauty and the positivity in life, then you can too. Do you still feel like that?
Well said, me. Yeah. Yeah, that's completely, if there's any one point to what I do, it would be that, yeah.
Well, I ask that because at this time, I mean, people are losing hope in a big way. And I just wonder how, if it's eroded any of your hopefulness.
It's tough. You know, I definitely have sleepless nights about it. And, you know, because it is really hard to not get sucked under and get depressed about what the state of things currently. But I just keep trying to hang on to a couple things. One is, in all of history, there's always periods where people are like, this is the worst year in history. And maybe it was at that point, but it always got better. And I have to believe that's going to be true this time too. And the other thing I keep holding on to is it could always be worse. About a month ago or so, one day I was starting to get pretty down about this year. And then that night, there was a big earthquake here in California. It was quite scary. And suddenly I was like, oh, I missed yesterday when it was just the pandemic and all the social upheaval and all the political stuff.
Are you able to get together with people and play music, or is that something that's not an option right now?
That isn't really an option, you know, and that is the hard part for me. Like, in a lot of ways, I'm lucky because it's probably easier for me to be in the lockdown situation because I work at home anyway, and I tend to lead kind of a reclusive lifestyle anyway. The hard part for me is we can't go out on the road, and we had big plans to do a lot of shows.
How do you feel about not performing?
Well, you know, we've been trying to figure out some way to do like an online performance that would be interesting and fun, and we haven't thought of it yet. I mean, for me, it's difficult because the ones I've seen so far, so they feel so sterile, and they just depress me and remind me what we can't do. You know, most singers nowadays use in-ear monitors, and I can't do that because I gotta be part of the room. I need to hear the people. I want to hear everyone breathing and screaming and stuff. What we're doing right now is we just posted a complete show that we did just a year ago that people can watch online, you know, with real people screaming and clapping and stuff, and that to me is more satisfying.
What do you want people to get out of Earth to Dora?
If it can cheer up some people or bring them any pleasure, or, you know, if there's one of the sadder moments on the album, makes them feel better in the misery loves company way, any of that, you know, I just hope it can provide any comfort.
Well, Mark Oliver Everett, thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Thanks. This is a real pleasure.
Mark Oliver Everett is the frontman of the indie rock band Eels. He spoke to Beta's Steve Gotcher about their album Earth to Dora. You can find out more about Mark and the album at wpr.org/beta.
You can't be an NBA player and go in the stands and beat up the very customers who are paying for your game. And then if you make that decision, you better hit the right guy.
Renowned sportscaster Jim Gray joins us to talk about interviewing some of the greatest athletes ever. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Gray is one of the most accomplished sportscasters in history. He's covered nearly every significant sporting event in the world, including the Olympics, Super Bowls, boxing title fights, and World Series. His career spans over four decades, and his trophy cabinet includes 12 Emmy Awards. During that time, Jim has had the honor of interviewing some of the greatest and most iconic athletes ever, including Michael Jordan, Michael Phelps, Tiger Woods, and Tom Brady. You can't rack up that kind of resume without having some stories to share. Luckily for us, Jim does in his memoir, Talking to Goats. In the book, Jim reflects back on some of the highlights of his broadcasting career. He also details the lowlights and some of the infamous and bizarre sports events he was a part of. We zoomed in with Jim from his LA home to talk about some of these moments, what he regrets, what he doesn't, and who he considers to be the GOAT interview.
Well, it's got to be Muhammad Ali. He invented it. He created it. And he was just so much fun and so creative. And, you know, he's beyond legendary and iconic. His name will withstand the test of time, what he stood for in the ring and achieved, and what he stood for outside of the ring and the principles and everything that went on in his life. That's why his name's on top.
There you go. Yeah. The late comedian Gary Shandling said that you should have a TV show called I Can Make You Hit Me. What did he mean by that?
Well, I guess he felt that I asked penetrating questions, you know, at times were possibly uncomfortable for some folks that, you know, in trying to ascertain that information, perhaps somebody might want to hit me. Never happened.
Never happened. No,
I mean, no. Much to Gary's chagrin. he was a dear friend and I miss him.
Take us back to Saturday, June 28th, 1997, the boxing match that was originally billed as The Sound and the Fury, but was retroactively referred to as the Bite Fight. It was the WBA heavyweight championship between Mike Tyson and Evander Holyfield.
Well, it was a much anticipated rematch because Holyfield had unexpectedly, at least to the public, not to him, beaten Tyson in that fight. And so this was going to be the revenge that Mike was going to be able to enact and extract. Based on having lost that fight that, you know, was considered a huge upset at that time. So there was a lot of anticipation for it. There was a lot of, you know, it was a worldwide huge spectacle.
The waiting is over. The talking is done. The rematch is here. Evander Holyfield, confident, relaxed. Mike Tyson predicting a sensational victory. The sense of anticipation as before the first fight is almost palpable. Here we go, fight two, round one.
That's what Mike Tyson brought to the ring. It was a train wreck that everybody had to see, but nobody had ever suggested or would have even thought that he would bite off another man's earlobe.
A very angry Evander Holyfield now. A left hook.
You know, it's funny, Tyson. Mike was having his best round.
He did it again. Mike Tyson has Evander Holyfield for the second time, and it is all out war.
I saw that one. That was right clear. It's a miracle he didn't get bit back.
I'll tell you what, this is unbelievable.
It was something we hadn't seen before. It is something we had not seen since. And it is highly unlikely that there will be anything quite like that again, particularly by somebody who was the youngest heavyweight champion of all time in a rematch for the title.
Let's go over to Jim Gray.
All right, thank you very much, Steve Albert. Steve, thank you very much. I have Mills Lane. Mills, why did you stop the fight? Because of the first bite on the ear or the second?
The second one. The first one was a foul. It took 2 points. The doctor said he could continue.
And in the midst of this brouhaha, you finally got a chance to interview Mike Tyson. Can you give us a blow-by-blow account, no pun intended, of that interview?
Well, Tyson, the referee Mills Lane stopped the fight. So the sheriff's department and the police got in the ring and it was chaos and they finally got him out of the ring and, you know, all kinds of debris being thrown at him and, you know, chaos in the ring and outside and with the crowd, went back into his locker room. So he was extremely agitated still and still, you know, he's a fighter and he still had all this pent up energy and wanted to fight. And so he answered the questions.
I got to retaliate.
Now, immediately you stopped. You stopped fighting immediately right there and you turned to Mills Lane and you said what? And the result was he did nothing. But what did you say to Mills right at that time?
I don't remember what I said. I told him that he butted me, but I know I complained about being butted. And we complained about the first fight. Listen, Holyfield's not the tough warrior everyone says he is. He got little nicks on his head and he quit. I got one eye. I got one eye. He's not impaired. He got ears. I got one eye. Big deal. If he take one, I got another one. I'm ready to fight. He didn't want to fight. I'm ready to fight him right now.
Mills Lane, no. Mills Lane stopped the fight. It wasn't Holyfield who stopped
it. Oh, he didn't want to fight.
Let me ask.
We don't know what Mills did. Don't put nothing on Mills.
Well, Mills said he stopped.
I've always admired and respected Mike because, unlike so many people who do things wrong, and this was a despicable, heinous act, okay? It was awful. He had the wherewithal, and he came out and he answered the questions. He didn't hide behind a press release or a PR team or a lawyer or go hide under a desk for 8 days and hope that it would go away and then, you know, just have the public move on and never say anything. He came out and he answered the questions, and he always did, and he always does. You know, he takes his own medicine. And how many people are accountable and responsible for their own actions? And like he said, nobody was going to take my glory. And even if it wasn't glorious, he created it and he was going to stand with it.
As you say in your book, it's hard to put honest and biting someone's ear off in the same description, but that was Tyson.
Absolutely. He's one of the last honest athletes, right? He will tell you what is on his mind and what he is thinking, and he will do it without any reservation or trying to spin. He's not trying to curry favor. He will tell you exactly what it is. Now, you may not like that, and you may not agree with it, but he does it.
The Tyson bite fight, this would not be your last bizarre sporting event. You were involved in perhaps the strangest and most chaotic sporting event ever on November 19th, 2004. It was an NBA game between the Indiana Pacers and the Detroit Pistons at the Palace of Auburn Hills in Michigan. It would forever be known as the Malice at the Palace. Can you take us back to that night and tell us what happened?
Well, that was you know, one of those very unforeseen circumstances. That was something that, you know, the game was basically over. The Pacers were going to win the game. There was a little skirmish out on the court, a hard foul, bit of an altercation that transpired between Ben Wallace and Ron Artest.
Ben Wallace was fouled, and Wallace did. Oh, Wallace right at Artest. This has potential to be serious if they don't get between. Wallace upset. Players trying to hold each other off.
And Artest tried to walk away after the hard foul, and he went over and laid down on the scorer's table and tried to defuse it and had a moment of zen. And all of a sudden, a cup full of suds came flying through and hit Artest, and that set off the volatility. And he had a natural reaction, really. It was a human reaction to want to respond to that. Problem is, you can't do that.
Now Artest has jumped over the scorer's table and is trying to get down to the bench. Artest is in the stands. Oh, this is awful. Fans are getting involved. Steven Jackson's in the fans. Rasheed Wallace going into the stands.
You can't be an NBA player and go in the stands and beat up the very customers who are paying for your game. And then if you do, if you make that decision, you better hit the right guy. You better find the guy who did it. And that wasn't the case. And then Steven Jackson, who everybody thinks is going in to try and stop the fight, makes matters worse because he goes in and starts fighting with another fan as opposed to dragging Artest out. And it just kind of went downhill after that. So it was a horrible moment for the NBA, terrible moment for the Pistons and the Pacers. And the Pacers franchise was set back really for a very, very long time because of it.
The one interview that you probably received the most criticism for was your interview with Pete Rose during the 1999 World Series. There was a celebration of baseball's all-century team before the game. Why was this interview with Pete Rose so significant?
Well, he was voted onto the field by MasterCard. In other words, a credit card company had taken over the voting and had paid a fee to Major League Baseball. Baseball had banished Pete Rose, so they had given up control of the very ceremony that they were now having for the all-century team. And when the fans voted him on, baseball couldn't take that away because they didn't control it. So they had no choice but to go ahead with it. And when they did, the fans basically were saying, "This is your time, Pete. We will honor you with this award and putting you on this team in substitute because you're not going to get into the Hall of Fame." So it was actually his Hall of Fame moment, and he got a rousing ovation. The significance of it was he hadn't been on the field for 10 years since signing away his own banishment from the game of baseball for betting on baseball and having there have been significant amounts of evidence that was found by John Dowd in the Dowd report and turned over to the commissioner of baseball, Bart Giamatti, and then later after he passed away to Faye Vincent. So there was this warm, wonderful, melancholy feeling of seeing Ted Williams up there and Sandy Koufax and Willie Mays and Stan Musial and Frank Robinson and all of these great players. And then all of a sudden, boom, NBC and I conducting this interview on NBC, come on and we start talking about gambling. So there was an abrupt change of tone and timing from the beautiful symbols and warm feeling that everybody is having about their childhood and seeing all their heroes and a great feeling about baseball to Pete Rose and his gambling.
Pete, those who will hear this tonight will say that you have been your own worst enemy and continue to be. How do you respond to that?
What way are you talking about?
By not acknowledging what seems to be overwhelming evidence.
I'm surprised you're bombarding me like this. I mean, I'm doing an interview with you on a great night, a great occasion, a great ovation. Everybody seems to be in a good mood. And you're bringing up something that happened 10 years ago.
Well, I bring it up because I think people would like to see you get it on. See, we got to go. We got a game.
Prosecutor's brief. It's not an interview. And I'm very surprised at you. I am, really.
Well, some would be surprised that you didn't take the opportunity. Let's go upstairs and have it. Congratulations.
Became very controversial. There was a tremendous amount of blowback and tumult and agita. For me, the reverberations of that interview struck a chord with a number of fans.
The man of the hour is with Jim Gray.
Thank you very much, Bob. Chad, tell us about that pitch.
I can't do it. You know, as a team, we kind of decided that, you know, we because of what happened with Pete, we're not going to talk out here on the field. I do want to say that was for you, though, Grandma. Thanks.
Well, Chad, you don't want to talk about the home run? All right, Bob. Back upstairs to you.
All right, Jim. Yeah, but this was a scary time for you in the wake of the interview because there was a lot of negative feedback. You even received a lot of death threats. I'm curious, did this experience make you doubt yourself and consider changing the way you approached your interviews? I'm thinking no, but I'm curious.
Well, it's a horrible experience and a horrible feeling to have all of that going on. Did I doubt myself in that interview? No. It didn't cause me to, you know, change the way that you ask questions. You have to ask questions to ascertain information, but it does cause you to revisit, you know, that you're having the same experience everybody else is, because it would have changed if I'd have been watching television.
Let's talk about the decision, which was broadcast live on ESPN on July 8th, 2010.
The answer to the question everybody wants to know. LeBron, what's your decision?
In this fall, man, this is very tough. In this fall, I'm going to take my talents to South Beach and join the Miami Heat.
Miami Heat.
Were you and LeBron happy with how it went?
You know, obviously it was a very difficult decision for him. And he is, you know, you could tell he was nervous, and he has subsequently said it was one of the most nervous moments of his life and had to be very difficult decision. He's from the Cleveland area in Akron. And so, yeah, you know, when you say happy, I didn't detect any unhappiness. I detected some uneasiness. It's not easy to leave the place you're from.
Yeah. A decade later, you now compare LeBron to former MLB-er Curt Flood, who all but created free agency in sports. What do you think is the lasting legacy of the decision?
Well, Curt Flood challenged the reserve clause, and he lost. But he ended up paving the way for true free agency in baseball. It was player freedom. And this, in the same way, all those years later, did the same thing for players in the NBA. The formation of where they wanted to go and self-determination, how they wanted to do it, with who they wanted to do it with. And while there had been super teams in the NBA before, they were never, ever set up by players. He took all of the risk and he was villainized for it. That was miscast. That was wrong. And we did a television show which generated millions and millions of dollars for the Boys and Girls Clubs, the biggest donation that's ever been made in the history of that organization. Should have been explained better. And we could have been more sensitive to the fans in Cleveland. It had to be very difficult to love the Cavaliers and to love your city and state and to be hearing that the best player in the game is leaving a place that he's from. But it also was the birth not only of this player freedom and self-determination, but social media and how players communicate. And look at the rise now in Twitter and the Players Tribune we now spend the majority of each season wondering who this class of free agents is going to play with next year becomes more important than the games that are being played this year.
Very well said. Jim Gray, thank you very much.
Doug, thank you so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Jim Gray is an Emmy Award-winning sportscaster and the author of Talking to Goats. Find out more at WPR.org. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Melissa Mertz, Mark Oliver Everett, and Jim Gray. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast. It's available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Special thanks to producer Brad Kohlberg.
Thinking of holding on to the job for a while, it's like, you know, it's money in my pocket.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I gotta get going. Me and my loser friends, you know, we gotta go get Aerosmith tickets.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Super dominant male in a 50s greaser uniform.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. And please take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
You just gotta keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.